Welcome to the Hash Out with Gene and Arthur,
where we talk about things that nobody else will.
I'm Arthur.
And I'm Gene.
And welcome back to the show, guys. For those of you who are tuning in, for the first time, my name is Arthur, like I just said, and I'm a clinical nutritionist. I'm also a registered dietitian student, aspiring, and I just love to learn things about life and how to make myself a better human being.
Cool. And I like to take long walks on the beach.
I like pasta.
I like turtles.
Turtles are cool. I like cats also. We have a cat somewhere.
Yeah, we did a formal intro last week, but I figured, you know, for the people that didn't hear last week's show, which was awesome, if you didn't, you gotta go and check it out. Full of good stuff. But I'm Gene. My background's in neurolinguistic psychology and clinical hypnosis, and a lot of other things revolving around human behavior. And essentially, today we're going to kind of pick up where we talked about last week, which was, you know, we talked a little bit about productivity and how people kind of tune out most of the time during different parts of the day. And then it was actually really interesting because one of the listeners sent us a chart of kind of how her working day goes. And it's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen somebody put. I guess this was like a PDF file originally, but it's a flow chart throughout the day from 9:30 until 7:30 at night, and it kind of starts off like sort of, okay, I'm at work, I'm getting to work, and then it ends up somewhere in the middle of the day. It's kind of like tired/jittery. This is probably when she wants to take a nap.
Yeah, you know, if you're looking at the ultradian rhythm, which we talked about last week, you know, it's that rhythm that it's subdivided between the circadian rhythm, which is, of course, the night and day cycle. But then there's many of the different cycles that take place within the actual 24-hour cycle. And, you know, usually after lunch, it's that siesta, which is kind of disappearing in more and more countries. But that's the time where your body naturally wants to digest and wants to go to sleep. Plus, from an evolution standpoint, it was too hot to work during the day, so it was nice time to relax and go to sleep. But the real interesting thing about that is it seems like the day is like you get to work, you're not really productive, then you kind of start to hit productivity, and then you go to lunch where all the productivity is lost all throughout the day, and then you start picking it up, and it's not until that you're free to end the day, you know, like it's past your work time, that people actually start to open up and put real work in.
Yeah.
And that brings me to some of the other feedback that I heard from last week's show, which was, you know, that whole concept of do the most important thing first with your day and then walk away. You know, whatever you do with the rest of your day, at least you know you've done that and you've accomplished it, and you're not saving it to the end of the day, which is really interesting. So, and it kind of ties in perfectly with what we're going to talk about this week. So this particular person was actually is interested in changing jobs, and what he would do is he would go to work, and then every day he would tell himself that when he comes home from work, he's going to go and do some job searching, you know,
because I don't need this shit.
Yeah, precisely, because he doesn't need that shit. But anyway, he goes, he would go home, but the thing is that by the time you get home, you're tired, and then there's also these other activities that you just want to do for yourself. Go to the gym, play video games, whatever, hang out with friends. And, you know, if he had the energy to do it, then it would cut into other things like gym, for example.
I would suggest napping on the train on the way home. That's what I do.
Yeah. Well,
I have
standing too.
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I have a whole strategy. See, like we talked about last week about life hacking. So I try to life hack just about everything as much as I can. So one of my life hacks is to get in the very, very first car in Herald Square where I work, because I know I'll get a seat either on either side of the train, and then I'll pass out, and I'll pretend like, oh, I have a bad knee or something, God forbid, just so I could sit down.
You ever feel like when you're on the train and you sit down, and there's other people around you, like you're not really, you should be giving the seat up to
some
old
woman.
Right,
like you're able. Well, if it's an old woman who's coming in with like crutches or something, of course I'm going to give her the
seat.
But
just in general, do you ever feel guilty for sitting while other people are standing?
Yes, but then I pretend like I'm asleep, so it's no longer my problem. And then I eventually fall asleep. Rather quickly, I might add. It was that something I read when I was looking into biphasic and polyphasic sleeping.
Oh, yeah.
When people try to sleep like 2 hours a night or something. So one of the things I read was there's a certain type of napping technique. Well, first of all, you should never nap more than an hour.
I thought it was less than that. I thought it was like,
it should be 30 to 45 minutes max, right? Because it has to do with, like, sleep rhythms and everything, so...
You go into deep sleep, right, and after you wake up real groggy.
Exactly. That's why, for those of you who have ever taken naps, and you wake up really irritable and kind of, like, angry at people. And I've seen that myself. I've met up with friends to hang out during the summer, during the summer times, and they're, like, really on edge, and it's kind of like I say something as a joke, and they're ready to, like, fight me or something. And these are the most peaceful people I know, so it's really funny. So...
Don't mess with people's sleep.
Yeah, exactly. So because of that, also, as I was saying, so I was reading something about the whole sleep less than an hour, yada yada, and there was this one cool, I forgot the name of the techniques, I'm not even sure if there was one, because I think somebody just kind of, you know, discovered it. Yeah, it was falling asleep in a chair while holding a set of keys. So basically, once you really start dozing off, or like a spoon or something, it will fall to the floor and make a loud noise, and you'll kind of, you know, jerk up, and you're kind of like, oh, crap, I'm awake. And you will be really, really alert. It's kind of like tricking your mind into, like, rebooting itself back into alertness. So I kind of do that on the train. I sleep for about 20, 30 minutes, and then I'm back in Brooklyn. I'm at my stop.
Ever miss your stop?
No.
Really?
I'm not, because you never actually hit, like, deep sleep where you're not aware of what's going on. Like, I still kind of hear, like, next stop is... You know, like the robotic voices in the train, like ding, ding. Next stop, King's Highway. Oh, that's my stop. And I wake up. Okay, maybe I've missed a stop once or twice. Well, it was late at night, and I may or may not have been somewhat drunk. So, but it totally works. And I don't know, it works for me. Now, in terms of your friend, do you know he was born in during the morning time or during the afternoon time?
I have no idea.
Because the same person that sent us that chart, towards the end of the chart, she actually wrote, 6:30 p.m., 110% total domination in the zone. And side note, I was born at 4 p.m., same as me, night owl tendencies. Apparently she read something that might have something to do with
that. This is a really interesting thing because... The whole idea that we're somehow predisposed to be one way or the other, and I don't necessarily think that that's the case. And just based on my experience working with people, there's no... I don't really believe that there's certain people that are night owls and certain people that are, inherently, like, morning people. I think it's really comes down to what your lifestyle is. Agreed. And how it fits into with the rest of your life. But then beyond that, it's just a pure belief. I'm a night person, so I can't wake up in the morning. BS.
Yeah.
Because there's different parts of during our life where we wake up in the morning and function just fine, and then other times we function fine at night. It's really about getting into a certain rhythm. To me, the more interesting thing is this. I find that a lot of people really start to work productive after their workday is actually finished. I think it's more of like, okay, I've been here as long as I have to. Now I'm really free to do some work.
Yeah.
Which, if you think about it, is, of course, an insane kind of strategy, but it's one that I know so many people, including myself, you kind of feel like you're under pressure to perform, like 9 to 6. And then after 6, you're really on your own time. You're no longer in company's time. And that's when all of a sudden the energy comes in. So many times I've been there before. It's interesting that it happens that way because that's not really when your brain is at its peak, and that's what I was talking about with the listener that wanted to look for the job. So he thought about, like, what's the most important thing that he could do with his day, and he realized it's looking for a new job. So his actual solution was to wake up 1 hour early, spend that hour looking for work, and he said it totally opens up his day. And then he comes home. One is that he feels like he's accomplished something for the day before he even left for work. And two, by the time he gets home, now he's free to do whatever, knowing that all of the other tasks are accomplished. It's kind of like homework. I never did homework when I was in school.
Me either.
But I felt guilty for not doing it. So, like, the days when I didn't get assigned, I was like, yeah, no homework. But really, it's the lack of... I'd say the sense of freedom for not having to do it, whether you do it or not.
Well, I'm completely the opposite because a lot of the subjects in school, I was actually genuinely interested in my own time. For example, history. I wanted to be a history teacher, researcher, maybe college professor or something. So in junior high school, when we would get homeworks every day, it's, you know, not until college that you really don't really get much homework. But I wouldn't do my homeworks out of principle because I would tell my professor, my teachers in junior high school, hey, you assign homework to make sure we study the material, right? I already read the entire history book. So clearly, I know the material. Look at my tests. I always get hundreds. So why do I need to do the homework? And they didn't have an answer for me. They would just be like, well, it's part of the curriculum. You have to do homework. And I would go, sir or ma'am, that is illogical. And I refuse to do that. And then, and therefore, I used to get 80s and 85s instead of 100s.
Yeah. You know what? The funny thing is this.
Imagine, I'm very stubborn. I'm a
smart imagine girl. You being a teacher, right? And you're pretty much taught to just kind of follow. And,
yeah,
and,
I understand.
I mean, think about, like, it's really a sad state of affairs right now in terms of, like, teachers are really looked down upon. If you're hearing fire trucks go by.
I was very concerned.
Yeah.
We live in Brooklyn, so.
Who knows? But think about it. Like, the people that become teachers these days, at least in kind of in New York, and not a knock against them, but I think it's a really necessary job. It's a really difficult job. But it's almost like people are looked down upon for being teachers, which is really crazy, especially a public school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then so a lot of the people that are really attracted by that, either, like, really idealistic on principle, or more often than not, they have, like, some other thing that they want to do, and they just want a job that gives them a lot of free time. So here you are, you're like, I just want to get through my day.
Yeah.
And you have some smart-ass kid come to you and tell you, I'm not going to follow your rules because I know your curriculum better than you can.
Right.
Than you do, you know? Like, well, what are they supposed to do? Like, am I going to make an exception? Is that thinking for myself?
Right. I mean, I wasn't trying to be, like, a smart-ass about it, but... I mean, also at the time when I was younger, I kind of didn't think like that, you know, just kind of like, well, I know what I'm doing, so, you know, screw you. But you're totally right in terms of a lot of people getting into teaching because they have other stuff to do. I had a lot of teachers in high school that were doing the same thing. I had teachers that were, like, golf instructors after hours. I had teachers that were musicians. I had teachers that were lawyers, and they just got fed up with it, and they knew a little bit about stock market and stuff, so they just became teachers just to get a, you know, steady paycheck, great benefits, summers off, and then they would play the stock market or their, you know, do something else with their time. So
yeah,
right.
It's really scary because if you think about it, right, it's there's nothing sexy about saying, yeah, I'm a school teacher.
There
you
should
know,
be though, ideally.
But this is the thing, it's so critical.
Right.
It's such a critical profession, and it's so looked down upon. I think that the shift, I'm not taking this isn't my own idea, but I've heard somebody else say it, and I really totally think it resonates. So if you think about kind of the evolution of workforce and the whole equality of gender equality, right? So if you know, like in the 50s and the 60s and even the 70s, if you were a woman and you wanted to be an educated woman, there's pretty much two professions that you could go into. One is nursing, and the other one is teaching, right?
Yeah.
And it was a prestigious thing for a woman who had education to go into these things. So what happened is with nursing, it now became like you have to have a master's degree, and it became highly respectable. And with teaching, it almost went the other way, where, like, who the hell wants this job? And it's really like the freeloader. I don't want to say freeloaders, but people that are not really, they're not really excited and passionate about teaching. It's
right.
More like it's a steady paycheck. You get summers off. I can do other things on the side. And, you know, if this is your second like thing in life, how passionate can you be about it?
Yeah,
you know, and it's a tough job. It's really tough. You know, to influence people. So I'm kind of terrified for what the future generation is.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree.
And it's spawning the need for private schools, which this is really interesting. For elementary level private schools, there are like six of them in New York that are actually more expensive per semester than Harvard.
Wow.
Like in the mid 40,000 range per year.
Damn.
Yeah. So to me, it's really scary because, like, I think just, you know, I'm 28, and I think that my education was infinitely better than some of the things that I hear about right now. So I don't know, kind of scary.
Yeah, I mean, I think the lack of metal detectors when I went to high school was pretty damn awesome.
Yeah, to me, the whole concept of a metal detector in school is pretty out there. Like, what do you mean? We had a lot of freedom in the school that I went to.
Yeah, I mean, the school that I went to didn't have metal detectors. They didn't have to turn in their cell phones. But I guess I understand that now in terms of the cell phones, at least, because kids texting and some more. You know, cell phones do everything now, so it's not like just for texting now, or playing Snake on your phone. Now it's just...
Snake, you kind of...
That's classic, though.
Yeah. But now they're playing, like, actual, like...
Video games?
Yeah, actual video games on their phones. I can't even imagine what school is like. I mean, when I went to school, there was no cell phones. So,
yeah.
The idea that anybody now has a calculator or Google at their fingertips...
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about it. Yeah, so you have an exam, or, like, a Regents exam or something, and you're like, oh, I really got to go to the bathroom, and you pull out your iPhone and just, like, Wikipedia everything.
Yeah, we have to, like, cheat the old-fashioned way, looking over the smart person's shoulder.
Yeah, or taking cheat sheets and putting them behind the label of the Coca-Cola bottle, and then turning the bottle so you could see the inside of it. Is this really complicated or something?
No, this is great. This is one of those life hacks, you know?
Yeah, this is totally a life hack. So instead of studying, this is what you do. Oh, don't do that. Actually study.
Well, so tell us a little bit more about how it's done.
So, well, yeah, one of the ways I remember doing was taking a Coca-Cola bottle or a Poland Spring bottle, because if you remember, the wrapping isn't glued all the way around. It's only glued like at the point where the both edges of the wrapping meet. So you would take a cheat sheet, you would place it facing the inside of the bottle, and then you would take the bottle to class and you would be drinking whatever it is. The reason I mentioned Coca-Cola is because it's dark, so you can't really see the cheat sheet until you drink halfway through, right? So you put the bottle on your desk and you keep drinking, and then halfway through the test, you see the cheat sheet, and as long as it's facing you and not the professor, there you go.
Nice.
Easy A.
Another life hack, saving people's exams. Yeah, there's some crazy stuff we used to do. I never brought stuff in. But I had some pretty creative ways. But I also got caught. See, this is the thing. I knew the material as well as anybody else. But I wasn't the kind of person that can then, like, if you give me, like, A, B, or C, or D, for me the answer is always it depends, depending on the context, which
right.
is why I was able to work so well with people, is because I could see it from many different perspectives. To me, it was really difficult to, like, just the art of regurgitating the information that you've learned, which to me, it's not really learning, it's memorization, or worse comes to worse, like, test-taking skills. It doesn't really translate into the real world.
No.
But sure. I had, you know, some pretty interesting experiences. So I used to always be good at identifying who the smart person was in any given situation. And then I would be very creative at being able to copy their answers. And the key was to be one step ahead of the professor by sometimes changing the answers mm-hmm. so that they don't look identical in an erratic enough pattern so that, that it's not really traceable. But one time, so the worst subject I had was chemistry. I did not understand any of it.
Me either.
And so the first semester I took chemistry, the teacher wasn't really teaching. He legitimately, like, he gave everybody a passing grade, but none of us learned a single thing in the entire class. So I'm coming at the second semester
right.
expected to know what was, and it's literally sounding like a foreign language, and I realized, oh my God, what a disservice this guy has done. And so I need to pass the test one way or another. I try, like, legitimately, I just didn't get it. This kid isn't even in my class. And he was like, he missed his class or something, and I knew he was smart. Like, he was one of those guys.
He looked smart.
You know when you look at somebody and you know, like, they look strange enough, you know that they're never going to fit into society?
And they love chemistry.
Yeah. He was one of those guys. So, and I was sitting right next to him. It's a 40-question test. And because he was there from, like, earlier, because he was actually in another class, so I managed to copy the first 20 questions, like, fill it in directly from him. And then he left. So I needed to kind of figure it out on my own, and there was no one really else that was sitting around me. Make matters worse, I told my friend about this experience. He told his friend, who happened to be the weird guy that I copied from, who actually got offended by the whole thing and told the teacher.
Ouch.
Right. But here is where my argument completely fell through. So I got the results of the test back. On the first 20 questions, so this is the ironic thing. The overall, like, average was probably like 65% around the school.
Mm-hmm.
This kid was the only one to get 100 on the entire test. So the first 20 questions, I went 20 for 20.
Right.
The next 20 questions, I went 8 for 20.
Okay.
So how do you explain that?
Right. I had a mental lapse.
Yeah. There's no recovering from that. So that was I ended up having to retake chemistry the following year. And I failed.
It happens to the best of us, I guess. Well, lesson learned.
I honestly didn't start learning until after I got out of college. And I started, taking all of my NLP and hypnosis training and actually took that really serious.
Right.
The applications of it were real. It wasn't like we sat there taking tests.
Exactly.
We were like, work with patients, work with customers, and work with clients.
Like Mark Twain said, don't ever let school get in the way of your learning.
It's just a really brilliant quote. So if we get back to doing the thing first thing in the morning.
Oh, yeah. That's how we're
awesome tangent. Yeah. We should have a sound effect for tangent and another one for life hack.
I was just going to say the same thing. We need a soundboard. It's like, tangent, life hack.
Yeah.
Bringing it back.
Exactly. Bringing it back. Like maybe with one of those turntable noises.
I'll get on that.
We got to do it. So the thing is that we're actually much more productive in the morning early on. Think about it like if you're thinking about like a computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have your RAM memory, and the longer computer is on, the more memory is kind of being taken up. And even if you aren't using it, like it's still like the programs are loaded. So you need to restart the computer, and then it runs a lot faster. Your mind is the same thing. So the reason I think that most people figure themselves to be more productive after they have to go home is because they're actually not on company's time anymore.
Right.
And they feel like nothing is pressuring them so they can be free to be productive, which is counter to what the job is supposed to be.
Unless you're happy at that job.
Really, your best bet is to get the most important thing done in the morning. That's actually when you're cognitively most aware, and that's where you have the most energy.
I also, from like personal experience, even before I kind of like read stuff about like productivity and everything, Gene has a claim to fame by being an NLP and hypno guru.
NLPist,
hypno guruist. Me, I've read a book on productivity that I mentioned last time, which was Mastery by Stephen Pressfield. So I read a book, and Gene has a bunch of awesome diplomas that he could hang on his wall. But just teasing. So I thought it sounded funnier in my head than it really, really was.
Hey, they're not all winners.
They're not. So what was I saying? I feel like there's some sort of inner reward system set up. If you, let's say, you wake up and you kind of walk around the house drinking coffee, a cup of coffee after a cup of coffee, and watching TV, and then maybe going online, you kind of feel like you're not accomplishing anything. It feels like your time is very ill spent, like you're not really getting anything done. But the times I wake up and let's say I'm off from school and work, and I have a list of things to do, and even though it seems a little bit overwhelming, it's like, oh, well, I have literally 45 minutes with my guidance counselor, then I have 15 minutes to grab a snack, then I have to run to see financial aid, and then I have to call my boss and figure something out from the day before. But when you do all that stuff, especially if it's kind of from the get-go, from the morning, it feels like you've actually like accomplished something. It's like you got your stuff done instead of dragging out throughout the day. So it kind of feels cool to actually do it.
It's a really, really cool feeling to get a bunch of stuff done in the morning. I mean, I like it. Like yesterday, I actually woke up later than I have in a really long time. I woke up a couple of times and I went back to sleep, but ultimately I got out of bed around 11:30, and literally my day felt like it was so short.
That's why I hate waking up past a certain amount of time. Even if yesterday I went to sleep around 3:30, 4 in the morning, and today, even if I didn't have to go to work, I still woke up at 8:30 on my own. My alarm clock was set for 9. But I really get that feeling your day is kind of wasted, because even though you're going to be up for, let's say, 16 hours or whatever, there's still a lot of stuff that you kind of could only do earlier on in the day. So,
yeah, 100%. It's funny because a lot of people, especially with entrepreneurs, I noticed this, who have like really busy days, the only time that they could really enjoy themselves is after midnight. And the reason is that there's no more calls that they have to make.
Right.
There's no more, there's nothing that they can do.
Yeah.
And then they're finally free to actually get done the things that they want to get done.
Right.
So a lot of times they're really trading off sleeping for working, you know, and or doing things that are interesting, you know, like watching a movie or something like that.
I feel like it would be cool to be an entrepreneur in a time zone where everybody's kind of like behind you or something, or maybe ahead of you. So by the time it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, it's nighttime in Japan, so there's literally nobody you could work with because it's already, everybody's day is over.
That could be an interesting idea.
Got to move to Japan to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah, move to Japan to start a business in U.S.
Yeah, I haven't actually
thought this through.
maybe I'm getting the time zones wrong, and maybe it's actually the other way around. You got to be in California to do business in Japan or something, so...
I think we just confused everybody, so we're right where we have to be.
Right on, perfect. So, back from the tangent. Yeah, you were talking about being productive in the morning.
Yeah, no, it's just in general, like, it's a really good thing to get the stuff out of the way, because I think mentally it frees you up. The longer the day goes, the more kind of pressure, and you start to become overwhelmed mm-hmm. with stuff. Because you're like, oh, I was supposed to do this at 10, and now it's 2:30, and I still haven't started it.
I'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah, it literally becomes so painful. You're like, I only got half a day left, and this thing could take maybe 15 minutes, but it seems really big right now, so why don't I put it off till tomorrow? I'm guilty of doing this. I'm sure a lot of people are.
Tisk, tisk.
Tisk, yes.
So, one of the questions we got from one of our listeners, and this is definitely regarding this stuff, how do you actually... sit down to do some of the stuff you need to do or you may want to do, such as, let's say, finding a job, or let's say, I don't know, doing some shopping online for some stuff you want for yourself, or maybe booking an appointment to a yoga studio or something.
I think there's a couple of things. The easiest is to not think about it.
Okay.
Just literally jump into it. The more you think about it, the more reasons you'll think of why you shouldn't do it. And the other thing is to think about one task. A lot of times you sit down and you go, oh my God, I still have X amount of things to do. And then that weighs on you. But if you just take that one thing and that's all you're going to do. So a good way is honestly to put it into your calendar. So if you're going to say from 7 to 7:30, all I'm going to do is meditate.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you aren't going to be meditating, you can't go on to your next task. Or your next thing until you finish that. So you either do nothing
mm-hmm.
at all, or you do what you have to do in that period of time. It's like with writer's block a lot mm-hmm. of times, right? If people sit down, they don't know. So the idea is like, look, you block off 2 hours, and you sit in front of that desk with a pencil or a typewriter or your computer, you know, and you don't go, you just sit there. And you could not write anything. But after a while, you do this enough times, your brain isn't going to go like, okay, I could do this again and done nothing, or maybe I could just start writing something and then delete the rest, you know?
Right.
So, honestly, the less you think about it, the more you can get it done. And I think a lot of it is the fear of actually sitting down to do it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Like I said, the most difficult thing for me when it was, you know, getting up at 5 a.m. was to do it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Once on the other end of that, it wasn't really that difficult at all.
For sure. I remember watching a video. I'm not sure. This is actually quite funny because I don't remember anything from the video. It was like 2 hours long. I just remember one thing that sometimes, you know, you're ready to go do an activity. And let's say, for example, you're going to do yoga, right? And in New York City and San Francisco and LA, I think as well, we have Yoga to the People, which is a donation-based studio. And in New York, we have quite a few of them. So let's say... that's what you want to do. Like, you're like, okay, I'm going to try yoga. Here, it's great. Like, blah, blah, blah. You get a yoga mat. You get some comfy shorts. You get a t-shirt, whatever. You pack everything, and then you're on your way after work. And then you get to the door, and you're like, screw this. I'm going home. And you turn around and go home. And it's quite funny how people will, like, make, you know, all the preparations, all the steps, but that last step, actually walking through the door, it seems like a lot of people like, can't do it. And it goes for a lot of things. Let's say you want to go check out a gym or something. And
yeah, I think that's a different kind of internal issue. I think mm-hmm. that's really more of a fear-based of being judged, or, you know, if you already put that much effort into it, it's no longer a procrastination thing.
Right.
See, a procrastination thing is more of just being overwhelmed with the many pieces. It usually is what happens is people make way too big of pictures in their mind and break things down into way too fine of chunks. Instead of making it one big thing, like I just have to leave my house instead, like, well, I have to put on my socks, but I don't have any dry socks, so I have to, you know, and yeah, then, yeah. You know, and then it's like every little thing, and then I need water, but I don't have water, so I need to walk down to the supermarket, pick up, and it becomes so overwhelming that you're like, forget it. Your body literally gives up and says, I'll do it some other time.
Hmm.
So if it's a one-step thing. But if somebody already went through, and I hear this in gyms, it's a big thing that
right.
a lot of people stand right outside and then they leave. And I'm sure like there's a lot of guys that are out there that have wanted to call a girl and picked up the phone, like got through putting the numbers in and never quite pressed the talk button.
Or they hang up.
Right? Like so that's a more of a fear of being judged as a result thing, and that's something else entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's really you got to connect yourself more to why you really want to do it in the first place.
Right. Okay.
And what the trade-off is. You know, a lot of times. But in terms of procrastination, the best way to do it, to deal with it, is just to put it off.
How do you mean?
You just you'll procrastinate later.
Oh, the procrastination part.
Yeah,
okay.
You just put off procrastinating until later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the same way. The way we would do it in NLP is we would actually elicit that strategy, and we have something called an anchor, which is something that it's a stimuli that's triggered by something else, be it a physical or a visual thing or something that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
So you could literally take the strategy of procrastination and then link it to itself. So you just keep procrastinating on procrastination.
Right.
You never quite get to it.
Right.
You put it off for later.
And
the thing is, like, people think about procrastination as it's always a bad thing, and it's not. I procrastinated on playing video games for years. I just, you know, to me it was like too big a pain in the ass to go and buy the console and buy the games, and so as a result, like I always said, I'll do it later. And then, you know, for years I just never got around to playing video games.
Okay.
So, you know, here it was a perfectly good strategy for something that I didn't want to do, that I really, you know, wouldn't have been very beneficial for me, you know. So I saved myself tons of hours just by being good at procrastinating.
Inadvertently.
The right things, right.
Right.
It was just, you know, so you can procrastinate on, like, eating junk food or, you know, doing things that you really shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
And in terms of the things you really want to do, I think it's really about connecting and taking that first plunge.
So let's say in terms of, like you were mentioning, the fear of actually, like you were saying, going through that gym door or something, which is an interesting thing. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a personal trainer, and he's got his own studio. And he told me the very, very first thing he did once he was setting up the studio, the first thing he did, like, you know, he signed a lease and everything, and he went across the street to a hardware store, and he bought a "Come in, we're open" sign, and he put it on the door. And he said that makes a huge difference, and people come in, and they always comment on the sign. Because, like you were saying, people will get to the gym, they'll stare at the door, and they'll think they're...
They'll start to make excuses. Yeah,
yeah. But once they see that sign, it's kind of like welcoming or something. And as I was saying, my friend says that almost everybody who walks through his door always comments, "Hey, like, nice touch on the sign, and come in, we're open," or something, or "please come in," or something.
Yeah, yeah, they need that final step. This is what it comes down to, the way that people get themselves into that fear,
mm-hmm.
to begin with. It doesn't happen by accident, it doesn't happen automatically, we may not be conscious of it, but it's a very set process, and it's probably the same for most people. In other words, in order to create a feeling of fear, right, there's something that you need to do, either say something to yourself, imagine something, a movie, pictures, right, of yourself being judged. Probably, you know, people are looking at you awkward, you know, they all have, like, these angry faces. The pictures make it seem like they're much bigger than you, right? You hear them probably say some angry things in your direction.
Mm-hmm.
They're not using very pleasant tonality, right? And internally, we start to create the sense of fear. So if I was to take any person and I was to ask them, you know, go ahead and feel fear, but you can't imagine anything, you can't remember anything, you can't see anything in your mind, you can't say anything to yourself, go ahead and do it, they can't do it. It's physically impossible. There's a strategy that they have to go through internally to actually get themselves to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
So my biggest advice to people that are actually experiencing it is to, one, consciously become aware of it. That's the
right.
first step. Two, you'll probably notice it's unpleasant people, looking, making very scary facial expressions, you know, and this is the way it's done.
Mm-hmm.
So if you then shrink the size of those pictures, make those people smaller, kind of move it away, take the color out of it, all of a sudden you'll notice that the feeling itself greatly diminishes. If you have things like that you say to yourself in your head, like, what's a typical thing that people say? Oh, they're not going to like me.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to laugh at me. They're going to think I'm stupid. I'm worthless. I shouldn't be trying this, right? It's this kind of dialogue. So if you think of, like, the sexiest voice you've ever heard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about saying those same things to yourself, but in the sexiest voice you've ever heard, say those same things, like, you're worthless, you know? And now try to get that same feeling back. It just doesn't work. So one of the things that we could easily do to change that fear is to make it conscious, kind of personify your demon, so to speak, and then change the submodalities, which would be change the pictures that you see in your mind, literally make them smaller, move them away, change the tone that you're using when you're speaking to yourself, you know, and things, as you do that, you know, things definitely change. Kind of take the sound out of it. Try, you know, make it either faster or slower till a point where it becomes ridiculous.
Man.
And then, you know, you'll stop believing those things to be the way that they are.
Yeah, I actually find that, like, what's useful for me is once I say a lot of the negative things, like ants, automatic negative thoughts, if I ever say them out loud, they already sound silly to me and stuff. So it's like...
And that's a big part of it, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, you know, you just, like, a lot of times people are afraid and they don't really know what they're afraid of. Because the process is so kind of ingrained that they think it happens. And this is the funniest thing. It's like, oh, well, my father used to suffer from anxiety and it's hereditary. And it's ridiculous when you understand the way the brain works because it's got nothing to do with your father at all. In fact, it's a totally made-up strategy. In fact, the way he gets himself to feel anxiety probably isn't even the same way that you would get yourself to feel anxiety. So it's not a hereditary thing. It's just purely if you do X, if you press these kind of buttons, you'll have this kind of a feeling. You know, so that's the case for most people.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, I really like the fact that you touched upon the genetics thing because I feel like genetics became such a big topic in our society for the last, like, maybe 30, 40 years. And everybody said, well, it's all in the genes. Well,
it's easy to blame, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my point because it's like a cop-out almost. Well, you know, my father went bald, so I'm just going to put a ton of gel in my hair. Or, you know, it applies to so many things.
How does it apply to fitness and dieting?
I mean, it definitely plays a role. And, for example, just because... Let's say it like this. Just because you have certain... you do have genetic material.
Like predisposition.
Yeah, right. So you do have, you know, 23 chromosomes from your mom and 23 from your dad, and that makes 46. and then you are a fetus, and then you grow into a human being. So you definitely have predispositions. But it doesn't mean that they're always activated. So just because your parents had, let's say, hypertension or any sort of lifestyle disease, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have it too. And I actually had people, I have two of my friends whose parents had diabetes, and then their excuse was that, well, we're going to develop it anyway. So they eat relatively well, but here and there they kind of like have a lot of junk food and have this, and lo and behold, one of them just got tested and she's pre-diabetic, so she really has to really clean up her diet, otherwise by the time she turns 30, she's going to be falling type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes, which is no longer called adult onset diabetes because now kids get it as well.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily about your parents, but you are predisposed to those things. So in terms of like fitness and nutrition, you still have to be careful, but it doesn't mean you're going to get it. So it's more like
a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. So if you really set your mind to, you know what, I'm not going to fall for that trap and I'm going to do everything I can in my power, it's more likely than not that you'll be fine, as opposed to, well, it's, you know, sealed in stone or something.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Bruce Lipton's work? He's done. He's a molecular biologist. He wrote a book called The Biology of Belief.
Yeah. Amazing stuff, man.
Yeah,
it's hard to believe, actually.
It's really mind blowing stuff. So what he learned is that there's actually genes whose sole purpose is to rewrite the other genes.
Yeah.
And really, it's what you believe sort of is going to make it come true. It's kind of like that you'll believe it when you see it.
Yeah.
Or vice versa, you'll see it when you believe it. So in this case, it's like, if you believe that you're going to get diabetes, you're going to do things and your cells are going to do things to make sure that you do indeed have diabetes.
Right. Essentially, the way he's saying it is basically on the molecular level, you're going to create that energy, which is going to impact nearby cells, which is then going to affect, organ tissues and organ systems to the point where it's going to influence your brain. For example, one of the things he was talking about was, I actually heard him in a podcast recently, I just can't remember which one, but he was talking about in terms of measuring this stuff, that there's literally energies that will impact your prefrontal cortex that has to do with reasoning, and that's your higher brain functions essentially in the front of your brain, and those are the ones that are telling you alcohol in excess is really bad for me and junk food is really bad for me, if you already know that. But if you're thinking, oh, I'm going to get diabetes regardless, it actually limits the prefrontal cortex's activity to the point where your animal brain kind of kicks in. You're like, okay, I'm just going to go for the junk food. Why not?
Like, who cares?
Yeah, who cares? I'm going to get it anyway. And it's crazy because, we were talking about this a few shows ago, that, people go like, oh, that's a bunch of baloney. But that's because we can't measure it. But now, apparently we can, at least to some degree. And in 20 years from now, we might believe and know things as fact that right now are only theories and the people call us crazy for it.
Yeah, it's the guy is legit. I mean, he's a molecular biologist, worked for one of the big schools, and I'm not sure which one it was, but you guys can always check him out. In fact, that's going to be my book of the week, Biology of Belief.
I was going to say my
book.
By
Bruce Lipton, yeah.
I mean, great stuff. It's a very easy read, and it's very fun, and it's you can't put it down. It's really a page-turner, and like Gene was saying, this is not some guy that just read a bunch of blogs online and decided to write it down. He's a very well-educated and respectable member of the intelligentsia, I guess.
Intelligentsia.
I love that word. Very Russian Revolution-esque.
Yeah, he's had a lot of... he's actually a really interesting guy, and he talked about a lot of the stuff. Let me see. Just taking a look at where he actually worked.
Cue elevator music.
Yeah, cue. I think it was the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, and then St. George University School of Medicine professor. So, and then eventually he was also involved in research in Penn State University as well as Stanford University Medical Center. So these are legit institutions.
Yeah.
And he's found some really crazy stuff. So I know that if you're completely new to it and you've never heard of anything like this before, you will go, how come I haven't heard about this? If it's this big a news, why haven't I heard about it? And of course, the answer is, what's in it for the people? What's in it for the news, right? What's in it for the people that are making
and the companies
billions,
of course.
If not more than that, trillions of dollars off of sick care.
Yeah.
My fiance got food poisoning it wasn't even food poisoning, it was like a stomach flu.
Right.
And then, so we ended up going to the ER to get her an IV. The ER visit cost her $1,000. You know what they did? They checked her vital signs, and then they put her an IV that rehydrated her,
mm-hmm.
and then they sent her home.
Right.
$1,000.
Wow. You should have called me. I would have done it for $500.
Exactly. I would have done it for a modest $800.
Yeah. Would've your 20% discount. Introductory free.
So there's... For those of you who are skeptical and they're saying, it's BS, I haven't heard about it, it means it doesn't exist, my suggestion is, one, first check it out, and two, if you have a logical mind, think about it.
Right.
If we actually do accept the fact that this is true, then the pharmaceutical companies and the people that live off of those pharmaceutical companies, people think about it like, big institution, top 1%. But bullshit. And there's a ton of other people that there's researchers, there's universities that are funded by them. There's salespeople, there's staff.
Yeah, the reps.
There's lots and lots of jobs that marketing people. Lots of jobs around this whole entire industry. And if all of a sudden things come out like the book Toxic Psychiatry, that's another one that talks about how some of these psychiatric medicines are really actually hurting people,
mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's in it for them if you could go and heal yourself by changing, you know, your beliefs or your ideas and doing some kind of things that don't require you to spend a lot of money going to doctors and you know, the American sick care.
That's why, like you were saying, the intricacy of the entire system, so to speak, and extends further from just healthcare into agriculture and, you know, sugar subsidies and corn subsidies and all this stuff and politicians and, you know, getting people elected and everything. And that's why when you tell people, when you talk about this stuff with a lot of people, they're like, they're very easy to kind of like dismiss it, because in order to really explain what's actually going on and how intricate it is and how tied in it is with pharmaceutical reps and the entire industry that's built around it and the way, you know, doctor office visits work and stuff, you really need to write a book that's like 2,000 pages to really kind of like chronicle what's going on, and it will still only deal with maybe the structure of the industry as opposed to the practices or something. So,
and then of course the people that are in charge, it's really easy for them to discredit anybody else by saying, hey, you don't have the pedigree.
Right.
Who has the pedigree? We have the pedigree.
Right, so who are
we
you?
We get to decide who has the pedigree, and we decided that that person doesn't, and now you try and go ahead and fight it. You know, of course. I watched this documentary on physics, and the amount of politics and backstabbing and things that go on in a world of science is crazy.
Right.
Like, there is certain ideas that if you decide to research them and you're really going against the mainstream, you're going to be shunned by the rest of the community.
Yeah, like, good luck.
You're not going to find... No one's going to hire you. No one's going to give you grants.
Yeah. And you would think this is like a hard science. It's not like they're talking about something like, you know, like healthcare or something. This is just like mathematics, essentially.
Well, there's...
You would think
so. There's a lot of really, really fascinating things about, you know, people coming up with new ideas, being shunned by society, being put down, and then 80 years later they're like, oh, that guy was actually right all that time ago, but at that time everybody thought he was a quack. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of the brilliant people in history, like Galileo even, I mean,
yeah, they Copernicus, right?
Right, exactly. So, and you know, these people like changed the course of scientific progress, and you know, they're essentially trying to get, you know, there was like lynch mobs out for them, except it was probably more than a mob. It was basically the entire population of Europe, except very small groups of people.
Well, at least the ones that mattered.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the ones who had the power, like, yeah, the ones who mattered. So we don't know with like the average peasant who probably couldn't even read things, but I think of it in terms of modern times, like, yeah, average human beings, not just Americans, but average Canadians, Englishmen, they hear something on, you know, CNN. And maybe once in a while they'll do like an expose or something, and some doctor will, with some radical book that he just released, will be on. And then there'll be a panel of 10 doctors that work for, you know, American Journal of Medicine, whatever, you know. And they'll try to discredit this one person, and they probably won't even let him speak, and then he'll sound like a quack.
Yeah.
And then you kind of like, oh yeah, this guy is a quack. But it's very unfortunate, I think.
Well, it's just, it's not limited. That's just kind of human nature. I mean, Edison and Tesla had the same thing going back and forth, with Edison actually trying to discredit Tesla's, you know, alternate AC-DC power,
mm-hmm.
Which was a lot better and more efficient and ultimately what we've adopted. But there was a huge campaign for a long time to discredit him, saying it was dangerous, it would kill people.
Mm-hmm.
They've even made videos of... they've electrocuted an elephant just to show like how dangerous it could be.
Oh no!
Well, but it's a scary thing, you know. They've made this. They've electrocuted an elephant.
It's and solitary. I'm genuinely disturbed. But
it's but this is the kind of things that they resulted to, and you know, that business is war, and all is war. All is fair in love and war, right?
Mm-hmm.
People fall in love with their ideas, and if there's a lot of money to be made, they try to fight dirty.
Yeah, for sure. And also, like I was saying, for an average person, let's say you have a set of beliefs, like, for example, in my industry, in nutrition, grains are good, carbs are good, fats are bad. Okay, well, it's great, but, you know, in the last few years, last few decades, but especially in the last 10 years with the internet, everybody's Googling diets and they're listening to other podcasts and watching video logs and stuff, and video blogs, and they start hearing about paleo diets, which are in nature much higher in fat and protein than they are in carbs, because they essentially eliminate almost all grain all grain products. So you just have stuff like potatoes, sweet potatoes, and carrots, I guess.
Do potatoes have any gluten in them?
I don't think so, as far as I know. I know yams definitely don't have gluten.
Okay.
And they're good for people who have like hypotension and hypoglycemic, so like low blood sugar, something very, very healthy for them. Gluten is mostly found in grain products, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
Anything outside of trace amounts. Trace amounts meaning it's so minuscule that it won't really do anything. Unless you're talking about micronutrients like vitamins and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Gluten is mostly essentially the sticky substance in the grain. That's what kind of keeps the grain together.
Oh, okay.
All right. So you can get a gluten-free oatmeal, for example, but it'll taste slightly different from, let's say, regular steel-cut oatmeal.
So through the human evolution, which is the way I look at everything.
Yeah. Well, if you want,
as people were evolving, were they more? Are grains not something that they consumed up until the last couple of thousand years?
Yeah, essentially. Because first of all, in order to consume grains, you have to cultivate them. So until the rise of civilization, which is let's say 10,000 BC, which is what all the archaeologists agree on, there was really no civilization. So people didn't settle down.
Right.
So there's no way to really grow, or I don't think they even started growing things like grain or corn or anything, because they would travel around. So they pack of hunter-gatherers. So you have to think about it. So that's essentially the paleo diet.
Yeah.
It's a group of people. They move around. So they kill some animals. They eat them.
Including the fat.
Including the fat. Yeah, well, they eat everything, because like think about Native Americans. They used to use like the entire part of like... the buffalo, right, that was like their animal, and it was sacred to them, and they would use everything. They would use the fur for the coats, the hooves, they would boil, and they would make fatty broth from the bone, which is actually supposedly really healthy as well, and then they would eat the meat, they would eat the organs, they would make everything, and they would just move on. And so there was really no time to settle down, cultivate grain, wait for it to sprout. You have to do stuff to it in order to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
So traditionally, yeah, for hundreds of thousands of years, humans essentially followed this diet that's now called the paleo diet, and it eliminates all. I'm pretty sure it eliminates virtually all beans, because beans you also have to process. If you take like
so including lentils as well, like
I'm pretty sure, yeah, because you can't eat them raw. You have to soak them first. If you take red kidney beans and you try to eat them, they're toxic. If you let them sit in water and then you drink the water is also toxic. You have to rinse them out before you cook them. So that's one of the things the opponents of like soy products, for example, say the same thing. But soy you could actually eat raw, which is edamame essentially. It's immature soybeans. For those of you guys who like sushi, that's what you're eating. Those are soybeans. They're not peas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, a lot of people think they're peas, but that's actually soybeans.
I actually thought they were peas.
Yeah, because they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
That's what soybeans look like.
Peas, they think, are a little sweeter than the
peas. I think they're also a little bit smaller. They are. Yeah. They're very sweet. Like, that's what if you ever had, not even like canned, most people probably think of canned peas. But
no, I'm talking about fresh.
Well, fresh ones taste exactly the same. That's why those taste sweet. There might be like a little sugar added in it, but even if you get like organic, all natural, no sugar added peas like in a can, they'll also taste sweet.
Because
like natural, they're very starchy.
No, I meant like out of the...
Out of the pods, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They taste great. In Russia, it's like a very popular thing.
They're delicious.
They certainly are. So essentially, you don't have beans and you don't have grains. And you know, a lot of if you go to a lot of nutritionists and dietitians, they'll tell you, oh, that's crazy. It's like some new fad. You just stick to eating like, a bunch of rice, like yada yada, it's so healthy. But if you look at it for the last 40, 50 years, this is when the obesity epidemic now, because it's such large proportion, that's when it started happening. And I actually read a very interesting book about it. It's called Good Calories, Bad Calories, and it's like 700 pages.
Ouch.
Yeah, it's tough, man. But it was really, really interesting. It's, for the love of me, I cannot remember the author, but it's a compilation of so much research that's been done in the field, and he talks about ethics of clinical research and how easy it is to really prove your hypothesis right if you so choose to. So one of the things he talks about is how the saturated fats became evil, right? And he talks about Eisenhower, right? Our president, the 40th. Gary Taubes, there we go. He's also been on a lot of podcasts. I've listened to him. Like, he's a genius, man. He's just very good at doing research mm-hmm. and presenting the facts and breaking it down how they work, and he just lets you make up your own mind. So a lot of stuff you listen to, you're like, you know what? I eat grain and I feel fine, and I'm in great shape. But somebody else is like, I eat grain and I feel bloated, which is the case for me. And so, therefore, I choose not to eat grains. So, but anyways, getting back to the point, he talks about how Eisenhower had a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of launched the entire, in that industry, but the medical care professionals, they started researching a lot of stuff, and they were like, well, you know, this is bodily fat, and it causes heart attacks because it clogs pores. This is a very layman's term, way of reciting right. history. But that's what they thought. They were like, oh, it must come from saturated fat, because saturated fat is solid at room temperatures. That means once you eat it, it clogs up your pores. Maybe if you eat it in, like large amounts, if you're just, like, shoveling, like, fat bag from sala. That's yeah. In the Russian culture, they really love cutting the backs of pigs, and it has, like, huge layers of visceral fat. And it's very white.
My father tried to argue that it's not unhealthy the other day.
It's very debatable, because if you have small amounts of it,
yeah,
it could be fine. And especially if you grew up in that sort of environment. So if you're like an Eastern European who's like genetically like, you know, like Slavic for thousands of years or something, it might not really be that dangerous to you. Because if you look at Russia, a lot of people in that... I mean, they have their own disease that they're dealing with, but I don't think coronary heart disease is like a big deal for them. I think they're genetically okay with eating that type of like high lard, high fat diet.
So that brings us to another question. So if high lard, high fat diet is okay, but in our society, being that a lot of the food is processed, it's
that's
not okay. So is
right.
it the processing? Is it all of the stuff that we... Because this is what I don't understand, right?
There's really no one size fits all type of approach. Because first of all, we as human beings, we're genetically very similar.
Yeah.
We're obviously way more similar than we are different. But those differences are very, very crucial. Because, for example, there's communities that live... in Southeast Asia and Japan that eat tons of sea vegetables, right? And they have some gut flora, gut bacteria that literally is not formed in Western Europeans or Northern Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put Northern Europeans on a high cold water fish diet, like a lot of salmon, a lot of tuna, mm-hmm. and a lot of sea vegetables, they might get very sick.
Right.
You know, they need their grains or they need their fats or whatever the case may be. But in this society, in this part of the world, because this is something they've eaten for hundreds and thousands of years, they seem to be quite fine.
Interesting.
But the processed food thing, getting back to that, it's detrimental to just about everybody. It's too unnatural. There's like there's a difference between different things and that occur in nature, and eating different natural foods, so to speak, and eating something that 100 years ago you show to a person, they'd be like, "What the hell is that?" Like, that's not even food.
You know, I thought about this the other day. I was looking at my fridge, and I realized that there are certain things I just don't expect to spoil, ever.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's in the fridge. Because I had this, like, horseradish, for example, right? And I haven't had any horseradish, but for some reason there's some in the fridge. If there's some in the fridge, I know my fiancé didn't buy it. I don't know how it got there.
Came with the party.
And that, yeah, so it must have been there for years, because I was like, oh, maybe I could put this on my food.
Mm-hmm.
And then I smelled it, and it sort of smelled okay. And then I ate it, and I'm like, I don't know if it's spoiled or not. And I'm like, this horseradish spoiled? And the very thought that there's some foods that don't is a really scary thing.
Yeah, of course, because, I mean, if you think about it, food is an organic compound. It's meant to dissolve in back... You know, from ashes to dust, however you want to think about it, but it came from the earth and it should return to the earth, or out into the air, and then back into the earth.
Yeah.
Via rain. But essentially, it's supposed to break down, because, you know, humans break down, animals break down, trees and everything break down, so should food. So if you're looking at something like Twinkies that are probably going to survive the nuclear holocaust or the zombie apocalypse or whatever's going to happen to us, that's a problem, and that's what you're putting in your body. I mean, we talked about in the last show about... the pictures of the McDonald's food that's like 100 something weeks ago, and it looks brand new. I mean, I'm sure it tastes a little foul, but you never know. It might taste perfectly fine. I'm just not going to be that guinea pig to try it.
No, the very fact that something is like that. You know, it's actually interesting. I think that it kind of ties in with a couple of points. One is that I actually read this. It's a historical fiction book by David Benioff, and it's called City of Thieves.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same guy. He wrote the movie 25th Hour. Okay. He wrote the book, but he also wrote the screenplay.
Okay.
Right, and he wrote
what's his name again?
David Benioff.
Oh, he's the producer in Game of Thrones.
Yes.
He's huge. I know.
So this guy, he's a screenwriter. He wrote like X-Men Origins of Wolverine and stuff like that.
Not his finest moment.
No, but this book was really good, and I had no idea what to expect. I thought, who knew with a name like that? And it turns out it's actually about about a story about two young like teenage boys in Leningrad during World War II. So what happened during World War II with Leningrad, which is now actually St. Petersburg, is that the Germans thought it was going to be too costly and too difficult to go in and take the city. So what they did was they just surrounded. Their idea was, we're going to surround the city, cut it off, and starve it out.
Literally everybody.
Starve it out, yeah. So so during this blockade of Leningrad, you know, these two boys were there, and the book describes what happened and what happened once people started running out of food, and it's just mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah.
One, I mean, it's a fantastic book, and it's really, really engaging and interesting. But two, the very fact that people could live through something like that. I mean, when we're not talking about like healthy or not healthy, they've melted down glue that holds books together because there was protein in it.
Some sort of nourishment.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they died from starvation, and this really made me think about our infinite capacity to take things for granted.
For sure.
You know, just infinite capacity to take things for granted because, you know, the people that even live through it, and I happen to know. My fiance's grandmother, she's 94 years old.
She's lived
through it. She was in Leningrad at the time, worked at an airport, got shot, and had a 3-year-old son, which most of the kids were evacuated at the time. You know, and then, you know, like you hear her talking about things, and like, man, it's just a regular person like anybody else. Like, they complain about the same things we complain about. Having lived through something like that, like you think, like if all I had was just one meal, I would be like happy forever.
Yeah.
And then you know, think we are, and they're probably just as unhappy or happy as we are right now as a society. You know, in total. Obviously, you know, a lot of people died. Maybe it's not a fair comparison, but I do think that humans have this infinite capacity to take things for granted.
Oh, for sure. Since I also come from Eastern Europe, and my own grandparents and great grandparents would tell me anecdotes and stories about what they would do, and that's you were talking about melting down the glue from the pages. They would also take their version of poison ivy because our species of poison ivy doesn't grow over there. They would take it and they would boil it down, and I guess all the poison would like evaporate or something, and they would essentially have this soup, which is basically water and some greens, like a few leaves of spinach, and that would be their meal for the day. And it's crazy, and here we are, like, you know, 21st century.
And we're complaining, like, oh, we got processed food and all this stuff, and that's so bad for you. Like, there were people that had no food whatsoever. I don't even want to talk about the things they resorted to.
Of course.
So we gotta, you know, part of this podcast, I think, is like we gotta laugh at these things and put them in perspective. Like
for sure.
Right now, living better than we've lived at any other time in history. The food that we have available to us, the healthcare that we have available to us, the shelter that we have available to us, the education and the amount of entertainment as well as information that's available to us, even to what we consider a poor person in the U.S., is infinitely more than the kings and the emperors would have access to.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, of course.
Not to mention plumbing, hot water.
I was going to say that, like the fact that they could shower or...
Or toilet.
or toilet with toilet paper instead of like some straw or something.
Well,
like.
I mean, you used to go into a bucket and then you'd dump it out back.
Right outside, yeah.
Yeah, so...
I was having a conversation with one of my friends the other day. He was talking about baths and people in the Middle Ages and stuff. And I don't know how we got on this topic. topic, but it was something along the line. Oh, I think we were talking about caves or something. And I was like, you know, I wasn't a fan of caves, but if I could have like some bear hide and throw in myself like a cave, I think that's a, you know, like a pre-jacket version of keeping yourself warm or something.
Yeah.
But like bear hide. But we were talking, and he's like, you know, it must have been cool, man. Like, if you're a prince or a general in the army, and you just have any woman you want. And I'm saying, I'm like, no, man. Women weren't the cleanest even back then. You know what I mean?
But everybody was like that. So you know, like society. This is another thing.
No, but this is just something he didn't think about.
Yeah,
I'm like,
they're not exactly what you would consider to be hot.
I'm like, you know, there's no shaving back. Yeah, I'm like, there was no shaving back then. They didn't have razors. So everybody had beards, and women clearly had, you know, body hair. And they do their business in a, you know, like in a, some sort of pot or something. They throw it out back. I'm like, they shower like once. They don't shower
once a year.
They bathe once a year during the winter months, maybe like around the Mediterranean areas because it's always warm. So they weren't afraid of catching a cold. They were bathing maybe once a month. But I'm like, just wrap your mind around. And here, even if you're homeless, you know, of course it's very unfortunate. But there's still places you can go to at least wash up. You have running water, it's warm, you don't have to heat it up, and you're not going to catch some sort of crazy virus that's going to kill you afterwards.
Yeah, it's great. It kind of really brings us into another topic that I always find interesting is beauty, right? If I was to ask you, like, what do you think dictates beauty?
Asian girls.
Go on.
No, not specifically. It's very, obviously, subjective. I mean, because...
Subjective to who?
To the eye of the beholder, I guess.
It's actually not even subjective to the eye of the beholder.
Well, okay, I think for us, being Westerners and Europeans, I think we might like, I guess, ideally, something we consider exotic would be something like a female with dark hair and dark skin, right? But I think for East Asians and Southeast Asians, they have an obsession with big eyes. That's why if you look at anime, they have huge eyes, and Asian people have much smaller, narrow eyes. So unless you're getting to a complete different
No. You're actually right on it. Most people do not know how to answer this, and they go into a rhetorical, beauty is...
Oh, it depends.
No. It's a very scientific thing.
Okay. Symmetry?
And you were... No, not symmetry. None of that stuff. I mean, yeah, internally, like, yeah, there's things that you're attracted to, nice skin, you know, like...
Okay.
Signs that you're healthy, but beyond that, that's not beauty. That's more of like figuring out if a person's healthy or not.
Okay.
You were on to it. What dictates beauty is culture.
Right.
Entirely culture dependent. In fact, if you go and look at people from the 70s, right? You go and take a picture of what a club looked like in the 70s, you're like, where are all the attractive people?
Yeah.
Right? Like, think about it. Guys had like body hair and big beards and, you know,
big hair,
right? Yeah. And women had big hair and
they look very unkempt, actually.
It's exactly right, and you're looking at that and you go, ugh, it's pretty scary. And then if you like look back to even, you know, in the 60s, and Marilyn Monroe, by our standards, was by today's society standards, was considered to be hefty,
a heifer. Thicker, yeah.
Yeah, she was a thick girl,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so now you look at the society and what's in style now, and you have, like, this obsession with being thin.
Mm-hmm. Double zero. Damn scary.
But the funny thing is, like, I'm sure you guys seen the videos, and if you haven't, you could always go online and find them, of, you know, the supermodels,
mm-hmm.
and so before and after. So one is that they do magic with makeup. But then after that, they go and they completely edit it in Photoshop, make the neck longer, the eyes bigger, clean up all the blemishes, mm-hmm. you know? So that's kind of our standard of beauty right now, and you have to compete with that. So within any society, you're like... At the time, women were unkempt and smelly,
right.
and men found them to be
Bar.
Probably even more attractive than we find them now, because that was what they had, you
know? That's true. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, like, that if that's all you have, that's all it is.
You probably become oblivious to smell.
And they probably would find it weird. They probably find the women that we have now weird, like, walking on high heels and being really skinny. Especially, like, those really good, like, even in that book, they talk about, like, if you see a woman who was plump, that means she was eating. That means she was healthy. And it immediately made them attracted to her.
That was the whole thing about, for thousands of years, people who were fat, oh, he must be wealthy, let's rob him.
Yeah, yeah, and now it's actually, oh, this person is thin. They're keeping themselves healthy from eating.
Yeah.
All of the so society changes, looks change, and we got to keep that in perspective. That what people think is, and the same thing with like you know, even in the 70s, like an attractive man, like even in the 50s and 60s, right? Marlon Brando and all of the male sex symbols, like, they don't look anything like that now.
Yeah.
You know, they had mustaches and body hair, and they didn't have muscles. You know, you look at what right now the actors look like, and they're all like huge built guys, you know, like really clean eyebrows and
clean eyebrows, like,
you know, nice clean touch. Hair, you know, it's interesting, like, how society looks at sex symbols and how that changes. So it's a really spur of a moment thing. You don't know what's going to be popular 20 years from now. Like right now, look at even the videos from the 90s, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah, I was watching I don't know why. So before you ask me, I was watching a Spice Girls video. I think it was like a VH1 countdown of women in music or
it's
something.
It's okay. It's okay.
Hey, I was big into Spice Girls when they were when.
If you want to be my lover.
Yeah, I used to draw them.
Wow.
Yeah, not naked, not like perverted. I just.
I'm kind of disappointed about the fact that it wasn't naked.
Maybe. I would get commissioned to create a orgy of Spice Girls paintings. But anyways, so I was watching one of their videos. Yeah, and it had a completely different feel to the videos like nowadays and stuff. But going back to what you said about culture, the very first thing I thought of was a picture. If you Google this is what you're going to get. Put an African woman AK-47. It's a picture of one... Eugene, if you want to do this now, just entertain yourself. It's a picture, I forgot the name of the tribe she's representing, but it's obviously an African tribe where they love the big lip place. She's got this huge lip that's probably down to her, you know, to her chest, and she's got a big plate, and she's carrying an AK-47 and an iPod. Gene is looking at it right now, and his jaw just dropped.
My jaw just dropped.
And see, you wouldn't even know that was a woman unless I told you, right?
And, my God!
It says what kind of what kind of background she comes from. I think it's called something with an M. I don't want to say Maori because I don't think that's it. But essentially, she's you see the huge plate. You see all this paint on her face. She has no hair, so you can't even tell it's a woman. And she's got an iPod and an AK-47. One of my favorite pictures ever.
Well, so actually, the interesting thing behind why they made that, why they started doing the lip things and the neck things and the ear things and physically scarring themselves.
Really quick, the whole thing with the necks, this is a little one of my many random bits of information, is people think it actually makes your neck longer. That's not what it does.
Yeah,
it actually pushes your
collarbone down,
yeah, and just an interesting tidbit because you can't manipulate your spine.
Yeah, yeah. It actually, so what we're talking about is in Africa there was a much like the thing that they put into their lip to elongate it. They also do the same thing. Essentially, they start by putting rings around a woman's neck, and the more time goes by, the more rings they put. And in the end, they make the neck look really, really long.
Yeah, it shifts your clavicles down.
Yeah.
But
the reason behind why that happened, and another tidbit of what else didn't you know, like this is another sound effect thing.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, what else didn't you know? So the reason why they were doing that is because slavery became very popular.
Okay.
And the slave masters would take the most healthiest looking slaves because they would sell them for most money.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized if they made themselves look hideous by elongating their lips
really?
And necks, scarring themselves, they were just not they were so shocking that people didn't want to buy them.
And now it became like a...
Well, it just stayed. It just kind of stayed from that era. But that's kind of how it went.
Yeah, but now it's considered like attractive for them.
Well,
men.
But the thing is that just shows you how adaptable society
right, that's
is.
Crazy.
Now they started to find it. They started to find it attractive. That's all they live around. And they find it to be attractive. Whereas for the rest of the world, you know, we're really terrified. My jaw literally dropped. As I seen, I was speechless. But for them, that's kind of the ultimate symbol of beauty. But how is that any more hideous? If you think about it, yesterday I was browsing the internet, and I saw a video of the woman with the largest breast in the world.
Okay.
And she's got something like the triple K or something like that, a cup size.
Something up there in the alphabet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And essentially she has more than a six-pack of silicone in each breast.
Holy crap.
And she wants to constantly get it bigger.
Oh, so they're not natural.
No. She was naturally a bee, and over the last, I don't know, 18 years or 12 years or something like that, she's been pumping silicone into her boobs. But, you know, like, to us, in our society, we kind of, some men are turned on, but I'm not, but there are, I can see men being turned on, right?
So, I mean, to a certain extent, I don't know about double Ks, I can't even look.
Triple K.
I don't want to see that.
Right. You do want to see that.
I'm good.
But, I mean, you know, for somebody from Africa, if they were to see that, I mean, would they also fall over?
That's actually going to be my question. Like, yeah, I wonder. It's very interesting. Don't show it to me.
Oh, come on. You have to see it.
She's going to trick me into watching.
All right. We're going to do this after the show. There's a totally other thing.
Yeah. So I don't puke anywhere near the equipment.
Yeah. So it's interesting in terms of the ability we have to adapt. And in terms of good and bad.
Man.
Like, one, we immediately adapted, like... Like I was talking about with my mother about leadership and management. She runs a company. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she talked about was like motivating her employees and things like that. And I said, so what is it, you know, what is it that's keeping them there? And she said, you know, a job, that they have a job. I'm like, okay, go on. She said, you know, well, they're hard to find. And I'm like, but they already have the job. It's not motivating them. People are not motivated by what they already have. So, that's one way of looking at it. And so last podcast we talked about why people are kind of stuck in the job that they're in and why they just won't leave, even though they hate it, even though they absolutely despise it. They want to find something new. It's not what they love doing. It's not their passion. What's keeping them there? Why won't they quit? And the answer, I think, is twofold. One is fear. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And the other one is random reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Random positive reinforcement, random negative reinforcement. A really interesting thing about nature and reinforcement. Because we want to know that if we do X, we're going to have Y result. Right? What happens when sometimes we do it and sometimes you get rewarded? Like sometimes you do a good job and your boss says nice things about you and you feel good. Sometimes you get a raise, and some of the times you don't. And then sometimes your voice is in a bad mood, and you get punished. And then so it's really this random reinforcement that keeps you from leaving. It literally, like, locks you into place. So random reinforcement has really two different effects. When it's a negative thing, it literally drives people and animals insane. They did these fascinating studies where they took a bunch of these monkeys, and then they put him out. It's a really pretty horrible experiment, but they put him into a cage, and then they would electrocute the floor once in a while. And then they also had a test group where, you know, if they did a certain thing, then they would get electrocuted. And if they didn't do that certain thing, they wouldn't. And so they just stopped doing that one thing that caused the floor to be electrocuted. But the other monkeys, they were just shocking them at random. And what ended up happening was the monkeys literally started going insane. So that's what happens when it's purely a negative reinforcement, is the person becomes insane because they don't understand how their behavior is impacting the world that they live in and their results.
Right.
If it's a positive reinforcement, however, it becomes addictive. And if you think about some of the things that are addictive, gambling, right, narcotics. Sometimes you have a good high, sometimes you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sometimes it's amazing, and sometimes it's not, and you don't know. And then, how about this one? Email.
Yeah.
Right?
I believe it.
Email is a really addictive thing. People are addicted to email, now we're addicted to social networking. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it shows up randomly. Right? Sometimes it's really good news. You know, it makes us feel important. So, this is the same thing at work. Sometimes we feel like, you know, maybe if I hang out another year, I'll get a bigger raise, and then I'll really start to enjoy it.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe I'll get that promotion. But it always starts off with a maybe.
Right.
And in fact, it's really interesting because if you take a group of people who are like really unhappy with their jobs, and then you talk to them a year later, they will mostly give you like tons of reasons why they haven't left. Like, now's not the right time. oh, well, I'm about to get married, I'm about to have a baby.
Right.
Well, the economy really sucks right now. We're downsizing, we're upsizing, there's room for growth. There's all kinds of reasons why they come up with for not changing it.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand the fact that you're being locked into this based on this kind of method of reinforcement. And then two is, of course, fear. What happens if I leave and I can't find another job? You know, like if you listen to the news especially,
yeah,
scary, right? Very. Like, oh, the economy sucks.
There's no jobs.
Yeah, there's
zero jobs. Zero jobs.
Yeah. Unemployment is what, like 12% or something like that?
I guess it depends who you ask, but anywhere from, like, I guess, like 9 to 12 or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Something,
yeah, like that. That means 92% of people are employed.
Right.
No jobs anywhere, right?
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's that you're ridiculously not keeping things in perspective. And then, of course, you know, what if the place I go to is worse than the one that's here?
Yeah.
What if I leave and actually I was going to get a promotion here? And so these kinds of thoughts keep people locked in, not just jobs, but also relationships. Well, you know,
I don't want to be alone.
I don't want to be alone, right? But also,
that irks me, that one.
It's a huge motivator for people not being alone. But then there's also, but this person was nice to me
That one time.
And they're hoping that it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
Right? And this is why I think, like, you know, part of abusive relationships as well is that they're, sometimes these people are really nice to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And very, like, genuinely.
Yeah, they genuinely care. They're genuinely nice about. And I think, you know, that's, people are locked into it. They're locked in by fear. And again, a lot of it, if you just start talking out loud, It'll start to sound silly, right?
Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of speaking out loud, I was going to mention this earlier. A lot of times, not only does it sound silly, but when you're kind of putting those things out there, you start looking at the situation from, like, an outside perspective, and you're like, if this was happening to one of my friends, I would give him the best advice possible, and I would tell him, you're nuts, just go do it, or go break up with, like, you know, like, you're obviously better. And it's, I feel like only when you kind of distance yourself from the situation, you kind of get a much broader, you know, sense of what's going on, like a better look at the bigger picture, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, that's actually precisely it. It's 100% correct.
I read in the book once.
Yeah, okay. So the main pattern in NLP, one of the most powerful things you can do for yourself is when you're in the problem, you could think about it as being in a box. If you're in a box, you can't see the door outside, you can't turn the knob, you're stuck. And because you're in this box, you don't see any solution. You don't see anything that's outside of it. The only way for you to actually get through it, whatever problem it happens to be, is to literally step outside of it, take a look at it, realize, one, you put yourself in the box, two, there's a perfectly good door there, but you just never bothered to look for it, and three, you can open it and walk right through it.
Man.
And then when you take that resource that you're lacking, and you bring that resource into the situation that you previously were terrified of, you were insecure about, now all of a sudden, the solution is obvious. You know, so with NLP and hypnosis, we don't actually do anything I don't do anything to you. I help you uncover the things that you need to uncover for yourself to see it from a different point of view. And the reason why, you know, even me, I pay somebody a lot of money to work with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such an unconscious process, by the time I realize what's happening, I'm already in it.
Right.
Right? And it's trying to steer the train from the platform which already left. You know, like, I'm on the platform, the train left, and I'm trying to steer it. It's impossible. So this is why, you know, you go and you get, you go to work with somebody, whatever modality that happened to work, and that's essentially it. They help you get out of your own way so that you can see the solution. And ultimately, honestly, if it's true, like, coaching and true, really powerful, whether it's spiritual work or this behavior change work, mm-hmm. psychological work, when it's truly powerful, it can't be influenced by the person who's helping you. The only thing that they can do is to put you into a space where you come up with a solution.
On your own.
If somebody tells you what to do, that's they're already wrong.
Right.
The solution has to come from within you. you have to be totally responsible for seeing it. And it's really amazingly simple when you take somebody through these exercises, because they come in and they go like, I have a problem, it's impossible to solve, I haven't been able to do it.
I don't know what
and,
to do.
Right. You take them through the steps, right, which is what we're trained to do. You take them through it, and all of a sudden they go, yeah, not only that, like, there's a ton of solutions, I just didn't see it. It's ridiculous. Really, it changes the whole thing.
It reminds me of when me and you worked together, or you and I. I'm not an English major, so screw that. When you and I worked together, I remember I had moments where I felt like giggling because it seemed like so silly, and the answers and whatever were so obvious that it's like, well, yeah, duh. Like, you know, like you were saying, when if you're not steering a person, you're just kind of like helping them like find this information within them and realize it for themselves. It's kind of like you were saying. I'm sure this happens a lot in a psychiatrist's office, if it's a good psychiatrist and he's not just, or she's not just there to prescribe medicine. I'm sure if they're doing really good analysis, they kind of help the person uncover whatever it is they're working on themselves. And I think that's like the best kind of epiphany is when it happens from within. You're just kind of like, wow.
It's the only way it can happen.
Right.
It's the only way. If I put my beliefs, values, anything into you, it'll backfire 100% of the time. It's because it's not something that's optimal for you.
Yeah.
You know?
When I took my very first philosophy course, I've only taken two, but my very first one was like an intro to philosophy, kind of like understanding what it's really about. It's not just reading a bunch of old guys from 3,000 years ago talking nonsense. But well, my professor said that there's a lot of philosophy out there, and they're all right in their own way, or in their own context. But anything you read, like, none of it's going to influence you or change your life. It's only going to reinforce what you already believe, or you think you believe, but you just don't know how to articulate it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the same thing. When you find something within yourself, or maybe it's something that's there but not quiet, that's the, like, long-lasting change that you could actually, you know, appreciate and comprehend and believe in.
Yeah, and there's some really powerful language that can do this. I played around. One of our guys came in from our offices are kind of spread all over the U.S. and so a couple of guys flew in from Virginia and L.A. and stuff. And one of them was, you know, he's a smoker and he knows what I do. And it's really funny. I kind of threw a few comments at him, and then he just started to really doubt whether he was really, you know, wanted to whether he was really even considering going back to it.
Don't smoke around Gene.
Yeah, it wasn't even smoking. It was just I threw a couple of things in, and he's like, well, maybe I'm reconsidering. And I'm like, well, maybe you're not. And he didn't know. And he's right. Like, well, am I? And I'm like, I don't know.
I don't know,
and I truly don't.
Yeah.
So really, it's the, if you bring somebody into, the way we put ourselves into problems is we're absolutely certain about it.
Yeah.
So if I'm absolutely certain about something, then everything around me is only going to be reinforcing that belief, like you said. So if you think smoking's addictive, everything you do will reinforce smoking being addictive. When we do a couple of techniques and we start to induce confusion and uncertainty into the situation, now the mind starts to open up and look for its own solutions.
Right.
And that's where we want to get to. The unrewarding part of this is that you... for the person that's being the practitioner, is that because it's such an unconscious change, the person almost literally changes everything about them, and then they go, well, I've always looked at it this way.
Yeah.
And you go, really? Like, sure. Listen to yourself when you came in. Mm-hmm. Those are completely two different beliefs.
Right.
And especially with kids, it's really prevalent. So my younger cousin had a phobia of the dark. Which typical for kids, and so she was saying, oh, you know, I'm really scared of the dark, and just you know, in playing around, I threw some of these techniques at her, and we ended up getting rid of it. And then so I said, you know, and then think about being in the dark now and alone and going. She's like, you know what? Now that I think about it, I wasn't really ever scared of the dark to begin with.
Yeah,
you know, and I see this so much with. With patients that have, you know, not patients, clients that have one that I've worked with, it was always like, well, you know, really, I didn't really have that problem. What I really had a problem was something else.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so to me, it's always one, it's rewarding that this person is not suffering with it anymore. But two, like, they completely don't give you any credit for it, which is another reason why I don't think it caught on quite as much as it should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go in, you get fixed, and you're like, well, I didn't really have that problem to begin with.
I just needed to realize that.
Yeah. Oh, like, what did he do? He didn't really do anything. You know, I went in there, I realized, you know, what I was doing was really stupid.
Yeah.
There's no reason for me to be afraid, right?
Yeah.
And then they walked out, and they go like, well, how long have you been suffering with this? 30 years. And then you went, and during that time, you realized on your own that...
It just so happened.
So
I like what you were saying when you were telling to your coworker who was smoking, and one thing that I like about, I guess, NLP and hypnosis and everything, it's all very kind of like cryptic and kind of funny, like you were saying,
artfully vague is the word we used.
Oh, okay,
artfully vague.
It's really cool though. It's like I like the fact that art is in it, because it's definitely
well, it's got to be, because you have to use the kind of language that would create doubt and uncertainty and uncertainty at the same time.
Like if this was on camera and people saw the way you said, like, well, I don't know, do you? Like, you have this funny look on your face, so kind of like, I can't read you, and it's like, it's very hard to understand.
Yeah. They were totally like, they totally felt I was messing with them.
Right.
But
it's
really,
part of the process, I assume, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if I start to use the kind of language where I'm going to say things like, the more you pay attention to the sound of your own voice as you breathe in and out, the more you may notice a shift.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's it. And then I would stop there. And you're like, what happened? And you start laughing because your unconscious body can't process it.
Right.
Right? And then I could do this enough time by doing things like saying, if you weren't thinking of all of the things that weren't really important to begin with, then you realize that your life is much better than it really is. Or it hasn't it? Right? And you just start laughing because you're like, what is he talking about? But your unconscious mind processes all of this, and it kind of gets overwhelmed, gets out of the way, and then people start to smile, and they start to laugh.
This is a genuine laugh, by the way.
It's a genuine laugh. It's the kind of unconscious laughter you can't elicit in just about any other way.
Yeah, understand. So, I actually have a question for you. I believe this may or may not have been from last week, or maybe I meant to ask you last week. Speaking of the subconscious or unconscious, me and you were talking about watching lectures or reading books and stuff like that, and I asked you whether or not I should be making little cliff notes of what I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
And you told me that you should just let your subconscious absorb whatever it is you want. So can you kind of explain that a little bit more? A couple of my friends were asking me about that too. It seems like wouldn't you be worried that you might forget some details of a lot of the stuff you're reading, or is that kind of irrelevant and it's kind of like the gist?
To put it into a proper context, as we usually do, if you are studying to memorize specific dates, names,
that's different.
Then you may need to consciously pay attention and take notes, if that's what you're being tested on.
Mm-hmm.
If you are listening, reading for your own purposes, my suggestion that you free yourself up, at least the first time around,
mm-hmm.
to be completely in the moment and just picking up whatever you pick up. The details are not nearly as important as the big picture.
Okay.
Right? The way I would study a lot of things, especially with NLP, a lot of people were really, you know, I've even trained people that were twice my age and had 10 times more experience than I did. But they would come to me, and they didn't understand how I was able to get so good so quickly. And the reason behind it was that I literally applied the things that NLP stood for,
mm-hmm.
rather than most people are like, I know how to do it, let me do it my way. And of course it didn't work, because it wasn't the same thing,
mm-hmm.
right? So what I ended up doing was, the first time, I'm just going to free myself, and I'm going to go and enjoy the program. I'm not going to take any notes, whether I'm listening to a lecture, whether I'm reading a book. I'm not going to take any notes. I'm not going to have any expectations. I'm just curious about the subject, so I'm going to go through it. If it's then good, then I'll go back and I'll do it again, now paying attention to more of the things that are really relevant. The third time I come around, now I'm taking specific notes, because that means I'm walking away with something. Now I already have the context. I know the specifics, and now I know what the specifics that I want to walk away with are. So if you are going in trying to learn, for me it's been a very powerful strategy. Set the context. How do you know what to highlight if you don't know? Like, you're like, oh, this looks important, and this looks important.
You end up highlighting the whole book.
Right, right. But if it wasn't important, the author wouldn't have put it into the book in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you don't know what you don't know yet. You don't know what's the real important thing. And a lot of times it might be a throwaway line that really holds the key to it all.
Yeah, you're right.
It was amazing because, you know, we spent a lot of time, me and a group of people that I was studying this stuff with, we spent a lot of time and a lot of details and looking at a lot of different details and things. And you realize, like, one of the master trainers would throw a line out and you go, that was a throwaway line, but that had more profound things that he talked about in the last hour. But it didn't even register the first few times around. Mm-hmm. So you start to kind of drawing down to finer and finer distinctions, and then you know what you want to learn, what you want to take away from that.
Right. That was one of the problems I had with the book I was mentioning earlier, Good Calories, Bad Calories, is because it's 700 pages. So I ended up literally trying to highlight something on every page because it all seemed so cool. But then a few pages later, I completely forgot what I even highlighted.
Or why I highlighted it.
Yeah, some of it was like cool quotes or something. Some of it was good facts. But I didn't remember that until I went back and took a look at it. So it's quite interesting.
And again, this is, don't let your education get in the way of your learning.
Exactly.
If your job is to pass a test, which is going to be 100% based on memorization of random facts, then study the random facts.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the time the tests don't test the big picture whatsoever.
Yeah.
They don't care about the big picture, they care about the specifics. You know, I've taken many a psychology classes in college, which were kind of really, really rudimentary, and a lot of the information was outdated, but mm-hmm. I have a minor in psychology. You spend the semester learning about things, and then you get to the test and you're like, what's the chemical that's responsible for X?
Yeah.
And what's the thing that's responsible for Y? And what was the date that this experiment was uncovered? And you're like, who gives a shit?
Yeah, I like a real-world clinical application of it. And there's a difference because, for example, when I got my clinical nutritionist license, it was really real-world applications. How do you do this? When this is happening, why is this happening? When this is in the system, holy crap. That was a loud crack, cool. I love cracking, man. Like, side note. By the way, guys, I've taken some Bacopa and some CDP choline. It's like a brain stimulant. It's like a natural Ritalin type of drug. So it's kind of like all over the place.
Oh, it's good. It's very... speaking of things all over the place, I noticed that you come here with a humongous book bag.
Okay, it's not like a camping book bag, but it is pretty big.
Well, it's one step down.
It is one step down. It's a camel bag from JanSport. It has like a water bottle thingy.
Yeah. So tell me what's in it. Tell our listeners why you have to carry such a huge bag around with you.
Besides my Bacopa, my CDP choline, and my probiotics, and my...
But that's only responsible for about 10 pounds of the stuff.
Right. It's only a bunch of little vials, little medicine, little pill dispenser vials, but I have at all times on me, unless I'm going out to party or something, I usually have my book bag, and inside my book bag I have at least two snacks and 40 ounces of water in my clean canteen bottle, which is right here. It's very green.
Nice.
Yeah, very cool. So, and I'll give you like a typical day when I have school and then I have work, right? So I'll wake up, I'll do my thing. One of the things I'm going to suggest to you in just a little bit has to do with waking up. So I do my thing and I'm getting ready for work. So I know I'm going to need to have lunch at least once. So I'll make like a salad and some Tupperware, right? So I have a salad, I have some fruits, I have like some, maybe like some nuts or some sort of like healthy fats. So I have like an apple, couple of maybe like an orange, maybe a banana. So, and then I'll have my water. And then maybe I'll have like some sort of wrap, like some vegan wrap made out of flaxseed roll instead of like yeast and like wheat. What else? So I have my water. I have my toothbrush in there. I really do. I have my fluoride-free blue and green algae toothpaste sample pack. Because, I mean, I'm going to be out for the whole day. I have class at 9, and it's over at 12:20, and then I have work from 12 to 8, from 2 to 8. So it's like 12 hours a day I'm out of the house. What else? Maybe I'll have a change of clothes, or like at least a shirt. I'm trying to think what else is in there. Oh, I have nail clippers and a nail filer, because before I go to the jiu-jitsu, sometimes you notice you have long nails. And it's one of my pet peeves when I grapple with people who end up, like,
ripping. Yeah, yeah, you look like you've been attacked by a Wolverine.
Yeah, dude, I have scars on my hands.
From me too. There's plenty of them.
By the way, jiu-jitsu is, like, for such a gentle sport, it's
yeah, there's nothing gentle about jiu-jitsu.
No, there's nothing, and I've noticed I actually walk away with a lot more scars and scrapes and cuts than I do from, like, Muay Thai and stuff. And especially
jiu-jitsu, there's nothing gentle about the art.
I have more mad burns on my knees. And my like my ankles and like almost any other scar, elbows. It's all over the place, and it's pretty bad. Cause it's like you look like you get beaten up, but it's supposed to be like a very like you know go with the flow, be like water, my friend.
Whoever tells you that never felt what shoulder pressure in your face feels like.
Definitely not.
Or a neon belly from somebody.
Like a real neon belly, yeah.
Yeah, you get there's certain some positions that like guys that are really good get you, and you want to die. You want to like. You want to give them anything and anything just to get them to stop this.
Yeah, take my lunch money and go for it.
It's like that. But I think the more important thing here is this. So you have this book bag and it's full of things you're prepared, right?
Yeah.
The real interesting thing about people and diets and what people notice about people that are generally overweight,
mm-hmm.
biggest difference is they're not prepared. they don't come prepared.
For sure.
And then they get hungry, and then they grab the first thing that's available.
Or something that's convenient, for sure.
It's really interesting. So they did this experiment where they brought a bunch of people, they invited a bunch of people to a group, like, meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That was supposed to be about the diet thing. And then they told them to bring their own food because they're going to be there the whole day. And then, of course, the people that brought their own, there was, like, most of the people that showed up did not bring their own food. With the exception of like two or three people who were the healthiest of the group. Then they did another experiment where they had a bunch of food that was on the tables. So they had like already prepared sandwiches, already prepared like chips and stuff like that, burgers. And then they had food that you have to make on your like salads and things like that.
That's my type of food.
And again, most of the people that were overweight, unhealthy, went directly to the made food. And skip the stuff that they have to do on their own.
Put together.
So really interesting distinction. And my brother's also really super healthy in terms of eating. He takes a ton of food with him. I usually come in and I have a lot of food with me, though. You know, like I try to stick to it.
We're very proud of you.
But the point is that you really the people that are gonna be healthy, they plan for being healthy. They plan for their meals. And they take time to make their own food.
Yeah. Well, if we were out like in nature, if we were like let's say out in like a forest or let's say thousands of years ago, we were like you know much more of a primitive subspecies or whatever you want to call it, we'd be able to walk around and pick fruits and food from trees and out of like berries or something. But we can't really do that anymore. So that's why you kind of a very old quote. One of my friends said one time when we were going to play. Football, middle of the winter. We used to do this a few years ago. We play once a week, middle of the winter, freezing. And this kid would come with two pairs of thermals, and then some crazy gloves, and you know, like just the works. And he's not like really bundled up. He's just wearing the right stuff. He's got two pairs of socks on. Yeah. You know. And I remember one of our friends came to play, and he didn't have gloves. So he played for about 5 minutes, and trying to catch the ball, his hands felt like they were gonna fall off. So he went home. And one of my buddies went ahead and said, you got to come prepared, otherwise you're going to make excuses.
So it's exactly
and it resonated with all these things. So when I get ready for work, I try to think of everything I need. Like, well, it might be hot today, so I might be, like, sweaty. And then, like, when I get to work, I might need to change my shirt or something. So I'll go to class like, in a T-shirt, and I'll take my shirt, and like I'll kind of roll it up nicely and throw it in my bag. But most importantly, I'm thinking about food. It's like, okay, so I'm going to be in the middle of the city, so if I want to get something organic from like Fresh & Co. or something, it's going to run me $28.
Yeah.
And I might as well, and there goes my, you know, like my paycheck for the day or something, and I'm going to be basically starving or broke. So
if you what's the quote? If you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail.
Basically.
Yeah, and it's exactly it. When you so for the people that have or are struggling with keeping a diet, the best suggestion is to remove any obstacles out of your way. Make it as easy as possible for you to succeed.
Yeah.
So essentially, if you're going in and you know that you have food that you brought with you that's healthy, that's the kind of food that you want, and you have it with you, then you're going to go and eat it. Yeah. If, however, you're in the middle, like you said, it's in the middle of the day, you're running late, you got a ton of things going on, you're feeling hungry, what's the thing you're going to do? You're going to go to the first place you see that appeals to you, and you're going to get the food that you don't want, and then you're going to feel tired. I mean, you want, but you're going to feel tired, you're going to feel weak.
We talked about it last week. Yeah, and I know I see that from some of my coworkers. They don't know what to get, and they'll sit around and think about it for hours. Literally, I'll come in at 2, and at 3 o'clock, let's say I'll have like my salad or something, it'll be 5 o'clock, and they still haven't eaten anything, and they've been there since 10, and I'm like, hey, are you ever going to go get some food? I don't know what to get. I still don't know what to get. All right, screw it. I'm just going to get some pizza.
Yeah. It comes down to I'm going to go get the most unhealthiest.
Exactly.
Something that's going to
Fill me up, and it's going to be like very energy dense. And a lot of times these are coworkers I have that actually know what they're doing. They're
right.
Not,
it's not. But they again, it makes if you have to work for it, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like I mean, I do this with jiu-jitsu as well. Like, if I pack my bag the night before, I'm going to be a lot more likely to actually get up when that alarm rings because I know it's already there,
Yeah.
If now the alarm rings and maybe I'm a little bit tired, I'm a little bit sore from the day before, oh, crap, I have to go pack, and I don't really have time, and, there's always tomorrow, and, maybe I'll go back to sleep. And whereas if the excuse is an option, you're going to take the option of taking the excuse. So eliminate as much of the excuses by preparing to succeed. That's essentially it.
Yeah, and I find it kind of funny, like a lot of people ask me, well, when do you have time to get this ready or this ready? It's you could always make time if you so choose to.
Yeah,
it doesn't take long for me to take a bunch of spinach leaves and like some cucumbers and like some tempeh, which is like fermented tofu, and some quinoa, and throw in one Tupperware thing and throw it back. It literally takes me like a minute and a half to do. So, but speaking about waking up, like you mentioned, I want to suggest something. Last week I suggested waking up and trying to laugh for 10 minutes. So first, did you give this a try, and how did your fiance take it if you did?
So,
or you got smacked and
so
that was the
other. I actually did not. It was.
I'm
about to,
sounds.
Yeah. You could boo me, and then I can also go and make a lot of excuses, but I did not.
Okay,
there's something about waking up at 5 a.m. with a person next to you who does not look at all amused.
Definitely not in the mood to laugh. Yeah.
No.
But those of you guys who tried it, I know some people actually did, and they got back to me. They said it sounds very, very silly, and they said, good, it's supposed to sound silly.
It's the point.
It is the point, actually. And
you realize how silly this life is.
Yeah.
Don't take it so seriously.
Yeah, just that's actually kind of like how we're introduced to it. But the very next thing I do, I think my little suggestions for the next few weeks is going to be taking you guys through my morning ritual. And if you give it a try and you like it, stick with it. But so I wake up. I usually kind of laugh for a few minutes. And I try to be like as silly about it as possible, not just like hee hee, but I kind of try to laugh
like
very
like a real
like a Dexter's Laboratory, like a magic. There you go, see, you got it. So this is what you do at 5 in the morning or 5:30. So I do that, and then this is something I learned from animals. I remember one of my professors actually mentioned this in I believe it was Anatomy Physiology 1. She was talking about stretching and how important stretching is for human beings, especially with us sitting the entire time. And here's Gene stretching a little bit. He's flexing, and he's been hitting the gym, so it's cool. Sean, good stuff. So she was talking about animals when they wake up from a nap. And think about your cat and dogs.
Oh,
you have
all the time. First thing it does.
Yeah, they don't. It's not like especially in our society. I was talking about it all last week or the week before. I have friends who wake up for work like half an hour before they have to leave the house. I would be depressed if all I had was half an hour, because in half an hour, I haven't even made my breakfast yet, because I want to take a shower, I want to stretch, maybe do a little yoga. I want to take my time. I want to be comfortable, and I want to do it as naturally as possible. And that's why if you look at animals, when they wake up, it's not like they just like sprint up and they go run and get some food, and then they go to run to the bathroom, and then they want to go outside. Observe a cat, dog. They wake up, they stretch one way, they stretch the other way, they do like a downward facing dog type of deal.
Yeah,
it's
funny when the cats do that too. They contract. And then they compress, and then they stretch.
Yeah, and that's it's very big in yoga as well. It's called deep relaxation techniques, and there's also deep contraction techniques. It has to do with that, basically, you know, testing out all your muscles and kind of getting accustomed to it. And also, when you sleep, the way human beings are meant to sleep is actually flat on your back on the floor. Okay, your hips don't sink into the mattress and all this stuff. But that's a completely different subject or topic. But essentially, when you sleep on your side, or you sleep facing down, or you sleep in some sort of weird little, you know, like pattern where one arm is up and the other arm is like behind your back.
You ever have when you like your ear gets caught underneath itself?
It's kind of funny.
And you wake up with the worst ear pain ever?
Yeah, it's like worse than jiu-jitsu.
Oh my god, it's exactly why I wear the big headgear for jiu-jitsu, and people are like, oh.
Big baby.
Yeah, yeah.
We make fun of you.
You know how much my ears don't hurt?
My ears don't hurt. I just have to warm them up. You just kind of go like this, make little ear circles. All right, fine. You're probably right.
No cauliflower ear for me.
I have no cauliflower. I mean, maybe a little bit, but they kind of look retarded. Well, some cauliflower ears look really, really bad. Some kind of look all right. But anyway, so yeah, getting back to the stretching thing. Yeah, you want to kind of get like used to being up, and you know, now you're just like, nice. And you kind of just stretch and you feel around. Like I like doing a little child's pose, stretch my upper back, and I like to do like some cat-cow. It gets my back cracking, and then I kind of get out of bed, and like I feel pretty loose and stuff, and it works for me.
Cool. I'm 100% all for it. There's got to be some kind of a morning ritual, and you might as well take Arthur's. You definitely thought it through.
Oh yeah, I had a whole blog entry that was like 3 pages long worth of morning stuff, and one of my friends read it. He was like, "How long does it take you to do all this stuff?" I'm like, "About 2 hours." So he's like, "If you had to leave your house at, let's say, 8, you would wake up at 6." I'm like, "I do leave my house at 8:30 to get to school, and I wake up at 6:30, sometimes 6, and I'm not in a rush, and then I leave the house, and I'm happy. Like I'm not grouchy. I come out if it's sunny. I appreciate the sun. If it's rainy, I curse the
clouds. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, clouds are cool when it's like on the beach, but there's very few of them. But if they're just hovering above me, like, no, they're evil.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a fantastic routine, and if you don't already have one, it sounds like one that you definitely should try.
Try stretching and try laughing. I guarantee it's going to brighten up your day from the get-go.
Unless there's clouds.
Then you have to laugh a little extra harder, or maybe take some more fish oil or something.
You know what else I heard works? If you run up on top of the roof wearing nothing but a loincloth and shake your fist angrily at the cloud while screaming.
You do realize you're giving me ideas now, right?
Hopefully I'm giving more than you the ideas.
One of the things I do when it's like one of those days and I feel kind of like very drowsy, I do the lion pose, you know, from yoga, where you roll your eyes to the back of your head, you open your jaw, and you stick your tongue out, and you go.
Oh, I wish. This is like one of those things we need video for this.
We're telling you video. But
that was awesome.
You know, guys, I'll take a picture of it for you, and I'll make this like the cover on the blog, on my Tumblr for this episode. Last time I actually had a picture of Yoda, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, cool. So I think we're going to wrap up this week's episode, covered a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, you guys owe us like $1,500. Please make checks available to the hashtag with Gene and Arthur.llc.
Yeah, and if you don't want to make the checks directly out to us, then just suggest the podcast to your friends, assuming that you really like it.
Assuming
you have friends and you like it and you think it's valuable stuff. The only way we could keep this stuff going is if, you know, we actually see that there's people out there that are enjoying it. So far, the feedback we've gotten is actually pretty amazing.
Yeah.
In terms of the people really liking it, asking us questions. Continue sending in more questions. It'll make the show that much more colorful.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't even talk about this. We actually have a name now. We kind of like said the name twice so far.
Yeah.
So yeah, thank you for everybody for your suggestions. Some of them were terrible, but we appreciate them nonetheless. They were great. At least, you know what? I still feel very giddy when people actually, even when they send us something very silly, and I'm just like, at least they try to think of something. That's really awesome.
We thank everybody for contributing. The final name I thought we both agreed on was the Hash Out.
Yeah, the Hash Out.
With Gene and Arthur.
I like it too. I like the hash part more than the rest of it.
Yeah, we thought that it works on multiple levels.
Multiple levels, yeah. So, thanks a lot for listening, guys. Find me on Twitter, which seems to be where I get a lot of our comments and questions from, at ArthurVEE. And Gene also has a Twitter, but I still assume he has not been on it since 2011.
I've been on it. I've been putting stuff on it. It's just my name, Gene Plotkin. Last name is Plotkin, as in Nancy, and it's all one word. So if you really want to tell me how awesome I am, you can find me on Twitter, or contact us through Arthur or any other way that you came across the podcast. We have some cool stuff to talk about next week, such as dieting trends and fads, and some of the self-help books that are out there and programs that will guarantee to change your life in one sitting or whatever.
Yeah, it's basically going to be debunking a lot of
myths out there.
Yeah, myths. How we sold integrity for convenience, essentially, is how I perceive it to be.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about some of the adult onset ADD, which we were too distracted to think about this time around.
Ironic, isn't it?
Ironic, yes, which I think a lot of people are really affected by right now and are suffering from it. And then, of course, there's always going to be lots of questions, lots of cool stuff in store, life hacks, random tangents, all good things.
Life hacks. Thanks a lot for listening, guys, and we'll see you next week. Peace and love.